The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Charlie talking about the overall market trade, singling out some names. Tesla also on our radar. It's down about 1.8% in today's session, definitely off its lows of the day. And we want to get to a story that is courtesy of our own Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow and Dana Hall, a Bloomberg exclusive, talking about the company's plans to cut about 200 autopilot workers as it shuts down its California site. Let's get more Bloomberg News West Coast correspondent Ed Ludlow. He is in our 960 studio in San Francisco. Check him out on YouTube as we speak. You can see him. Hi, Ed. Hey, so tell us about this story. You guys broke it. What do we need to know? And was it a surprise?
Yes and no. There's a facility in San Mateo here in the Bay Area, and it was home to the autopilot data labeling team. And sources tell us that they were all called into a room yesterday and told that their jobs were gone. That this was part of a longer-term plan to move this team from one facility in San Mateo to one down the road in Palo Alto. Lots of those workers were expecting to be moved, but ultimately what happened was they were laid off.
Ed, I think you're actually at a port and that's a ship coming in.
Yes.
Is that what's going on?
It is, yeah.
So, Ed, I mean, when I saw this headline cross yesterday, usually you would see a headline like this and be like, oh, man, the company is in trouble or in some sort of stress that we didn't know about. Is that true in Tesla's case?
So, Elon Musk told our editor-in-chief, John Micklethwaite, last week that Tesla would be laying off 10% of salaried workers. Tesla's workforce is split between two-thirds hourly workers and one-third salaried. This is important because, according to sources, the vast majority of those laid off yesterday were hourly, not salaried. So it's kind of at odds what happened, because Elon Musk told us it would cuts would focus on salaried employees, hourly workers would be protected. Now, Elon Musk also clarified that a lot of the hourly jobs he was talking about growing would be on production lines. The people we're talking about are data labelers. They're working on the autopilot functionality. But they're still hourly workers. So it was a surprise because we were led to believe that those types of employment contracts were protected.
So is this a shift of a mega growth company, it feels like, as it's ramped up and, you know, been spitting out its vehicles? I mean, is that a shift from this company maybe not being such a big growth player but still producing a lot?
You know, autopilot data labeling is kind of a manual job and a thankless job. You basically take video footage that's generated from the cameras on Tesla customer cars, Tesla owner cars, and you annotate to help train the neural networks that improve the technology. People are doing that here in the Bay Area, but they're also doing it in Buffalo, New York. And what sources tell us is that actually that team is growing in Buffalo, New York. Mm. But sources also tell us that they are paid less in New York State than they are here in the Bay Area. So that's one factor to consider. But it's definitely one of these areas that Elon Musk has referred to where they grew too quickly to too great a size. You know, they're big teams. In the Bay Area, as I said, this was part of a sort of change of plan to move people to different offices. They'd been winding down the team anyway. But it's still interesting.
Well, that's kind of what I was thinking, because it caught my eye in your story that you say that the company, now based in Austin, Texas, it's grown to about 100,000 employees globally. I had no idea that Tesla employed that many people. And if you think about what we've heard from Amazon and I think Walmart, too, coming out and saying that they overstaffed. I mean, could that potentially be true in Tesla's case?
You know, I think what we learned with inflation is inflation took us by surprise. It surprised to the upside a lot. The macro picture and the supply chain breakdown continues to surprise us, and inventories of retailers is a good example of that. What I would say is that people have short memories when it comes to Tesla, and you have to remember that there have been rounds of job cuts before. You know, the stock performed astronomically in the 2018-19 and in the early days of the pandemic, but in 2018 they did go through a round of layoffs when things were tough. So we've seen Elon Musk be prepared to do this in the past, and he'd warned us.
Hey, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you, Katie and I were just kicking around some stories in the solar world and the alternative energy world. There's a story by Tara Patel about Stellantis. It's one of Europe's biggest automakers, and they are warning of a car market collapse if EVs don't get cheaper. I have to say, that makes sense to me, that unless we bring down the price, and I don't know how we do it, whether it's just, you know, being able to mass produce more. I mean, how do you see it, and how does kind of Tesla play into this, who has been also trying to, I feel like, be more aggressive about getting a car for the mass market?
Yeah, you have to remember, Elon Musk had this original goal of a $25,000 EV where he wanted to make one for the masses. Well, that's gone out the window, frankly. He's abandoned that idea. And not every, if we take the United States as an example, the median household cannot afford a $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 vehicle, especially a small one like a Tesla Model 3 or Model Y. They look for value. And you look across the market and the trend that we're seeing, all of these EV players, the Rivians, the Lucids, on top of Tesla, and the legacy auto like GM and Ford, it's very expensive high-end models they're offering. We don't yet have a true mass market model that is affordable for that median to lower income family household. And, you know, that's the inflection point. You look at China, where EV adoption's further ahead, they have a greater variety of model types and at more affordable prices than we have here in the United States. In Europe, again, more option, lower price point.
All right, to look into your crystal ball, what's going to be the next story on Elon Musk? Is it going to be Tesla?
Yeah.
Is it going to be Twitter? What? Just quickly.
Yeah, you know, Elon Musk has not tweeted since June 21st. I want to know why. I feel something's coming, guys. I feel something's coming.
Elon, are you out there? You can just tweet at Ed directly.
Come on Bloomberg Air while you're at it.
Yeah, exactly. Come join us. Ed Ludlow, thank you so much as always. Great scoop. West Coast correspondent at Bloomberg News in our 960 studio in San Francisco. You can hear him on Bloomberg Radio and see him on YouTube. Katie and I come back in just a moment right here on Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the Bloomberg Businessweek annual heist issue, it is out. The cover story takes us from the Cambodian jungles to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It is about an art crime for the ages. And earlier, I caught up with Matt Campbell, Asia editor for Bloomberg Businessweek from Singapore. Matt wrote that story along with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber. I began by asking Joel about how this story, perfect for the heist issue, came to his attention.
Matt actually wrote this story, and as he'll, I think, reveal here, actually the main character is a character named Douglas Latchford, and Matt had high hopes to actually talk to him at some point, but then obviously COVID happened and he passed away. So what is incredible about the story, though, is that it really speaks to Cambodia and the artifacts at Cambodia, but also the sea change within the art world, where artifacts that were looted decades ago are now in the crosshairs of investigators who are trying to actually return them to their rightful owners. So Matt, talk to us about Douglas Latchford. Who is he exactly?
So Douglas Latchford, the late Douglas Latchford, who died in 2020, was a British businessman who lived virtually his whole adult life in Bangkok. And among other activities, he was, for a period of about 40 years, arguably the top dealer in the world of statues from Cambodia, these spectacular Khmer Empire sculptures, you know, some of them 1,000 years old or more. And he really built an art dealing empire, and there are works in very fancy private collections and huge important museums like the Met and the British Museum with links to Latchford all over the world. But as has now become apparent, he was a part of a looting network and was facilitating essentially the looting and laundering of statues that were being ripped from temples, having their origins obscured, and then trafficked onto the international art market.
So what did that network really look like? Because he actually really never went into the jungle. It wasn't like he was an Indiana Jones character here going into the jungle to get these artifacts, right? So what did his network look like?
That's right, Joel. There has been a perception of Latchford sometimes in the past as kind of a tomb raider himself, and that, in fact, is not true. He directed this operation, and he did everything that he did essentially from his apartment in Bangkok. But what he did was buy whatever was coming over the border from this network of looters and brokers within Cambodia who knew that Latchford was a buyer. He helped create a huge market for stolen antiquities and certainly had contact with the brokers who were deciding to some extent what got looted and what got out of Cambodia. So while he was not himself smashing and grabbing statues, he was really the essential node in this operation. Without him, and particularly without his very energetic salesmanship, which made these Cambodian statues into really big money objects, you know, selling for high six and even seven figure prices, this looting would never have occurred on the scale that it did.
And what are the artworks themselves?
So we need to do a little bit of background history here. Cambodia, 1,000 or so years ago, was the center of something called the Khmer Empire, which was this Hindu and Buddhist monarchy stretching, encompassing all of contemporary Cambodia as well as much of Thailand and Vietnam, was this very powerful civilization. Angkor was the capital, Angkor Wat being the site a lot of people are familiar with. And these Cambodian kings commissioned massive statues. You know, these are 4 feet tall, 5 feet tall, you know, 600-pound stone objects depicting gods and warriors or themselves, you know, or their wives and children. Really beautiful figures. And actually, when you spend a little time with these objects, as I have, it's very easy to see how you could become obsessed with them, as Douglas Latchford was.
Well, and, you know, take us there, Matt. You went to the Cambodian jungles. Tell us about what you saw and kind of the massive, I mean, some of these, there's some pictures in the magazine. They really are stunning, but they're massive. And take us to also where, you know, who knew that feet would be so key in figuring out this heist, if you will?
Well, so one of the things that strikes you, you know, about visiting temples in Cambodia is, first of all, they are spectacular and they're amazing places and sort of overwhelming to see in person. But as you look a little more closely, you realize what's not there is that these buildings are empty because there were statues. They used to be full of statues, but the statues are all gone. They were all taken years and years ago. Some were taken under the French, others later, you know, during the Cambodian Civil War and the Khmer Rouge period, and then this really big period of looting, which I describe in the story, in the 90s, and that was really the golden age of temple robbing in Cambodia. However, this looting was sort of crude and left behind remnants and fragments, and actually, as you alluded to, feet. And one of the key anecdotes in the story relates to matching a pair of statues that had made it into Western collections to their feet, which were still in situ on the ground, broken off. And of course, it's possible, you know, with computer technology to 3D match these objects together and to determine this statue came from this place. And then if you can interview witnesses, find people who remember it being taken, you can actually nail down the when as well.
When and how did this heist begin to unravel?
So this has been a long and kind of interesting, very interesting process where you've had a number of private citizens, you know, heritage activists, archaeologists, other people involved in antiquities in one way or another, who have had suspicions about this trafficking network for over a decade now. But things really began to unravel in the mid-2010s when U.S. prosecutors, specifically in the Southern District of New York, began to take an interest in antiquities trafficking and antiquities trafficking from Cambodia. So there have been a series of indictments now, both federally and at the state level in New York, of people involved in one way or another with the Latchford operation. And in 2019, Latchford himself was indicted on fraud and conspiracy charges by SDNY. And that really signaled that there was this extremely serious law enforcement effort underway. However, Latchford died about a year after that indictment. He was very sick at the time, 88 years old, and never went to trial.
I feel like there are three key players in your story, and we've covered Douglas Latchford. There's the individual who helped him in digging up and, you know, finding the art and getting it out of Cambodia. There was also an internationally connected attorney that the U.S. Department of Justice turned to, Brad Gordon. How important was he in kind of helping figure this all out?
Brad Gordon is a really crucial character in this narrative and is really a remarkable character. He is an American lawyer. He's lived in Asia much of his career. He's lived in Cambodia for over a decade now. And he was hired by the DOJ about 10 years ago to begin investigating some of these thefts on behalf of the U.S. government on the Cambodian side. And Brad really became obsessed by it, totally hooked on the challenge of figuring out where these objects were taken and how they might be returned to Cambodia ultimately. And in that effort, he found a really crucial witness, a Cambodian man named Tuk Tik, who actually Brad referred to with a code name, Lion. And Lion, it turned out, was a master looter, an extremely prolific looter, and someone who helped Brad immeasurably put it all together.
All right, that last voice, Matt Campbell, Asia editor for Bloomberg Business Week. He joined us from Singapore. Morning our time, night his time. It's his story. He wrote it. It's for the annual Heist issue, which comes out every summer. And Katie, it is just a great summer read. Just these all these kinds of theft stories, intrigue, and Matt tells a tale like no other. And I'm just waiting for this story to be on Netflix or Hulu or, you know, one of the streaming channels because it's pretty incredible. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
July 4th holiday just around the bend. So we're talking hot dogs, hamburgers, we're talking fried chicken, shrimp macaroni salad. That's what my mom used to make when we were growing up and we had 4th of July. We're going to eat probably some different things, Katie, but safe to say that we're all going to probably pay a bunch more for it. So let's get to it and see what our next guest has to say about that. Carol Flynn is ag tech analyst at Wells Fargo. She joins us on the phone in California. And Carol, it's good to have you here with Katie and myself. So tell us a little bit about the pain points that we're going to face this 4th of July when it comes to what we eat.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Look, it's absolutely a pain point. Food price inflation is hitting everybody's wallets. And we wrote this research just to figure out where that pinch of inflation could be potentially solved by finding relative value and more palatable price points.
And so walk us through some of those relative value plays. I feel like I'm talking about stocks here. But when it comes to food in particular, I mean, what are the substitutions that one could make if they are trying to host a party and not, you know, pay a fortune for it?
Well, that's a great question. Well, you know, it's year over year in food price acceleration that we're looking at here. And the substitutions are truly going to be things like what else can we put on our grill. It looks like brisket is going to be more affordable than tri-tip this time. Maybe if you're going to stick with the hamburger patties, take a look in the frozen food section. Anything that's sort of had shelf stability or frozen foods versus perishable, you're going to see some specials out there and some loss leaders. It's going to take a little more effort to make sure this is the food price, the budget is taken care of.
All right, Carol, Katie's already weighed in. She goes, I'm not going to eat shrimp and pork tacos.
I heard that. There are so many organs in the produce department, and you don't have to have that. That's the beauty of the American food and agricultural system. I mean, we have incredible diversity of foods available.
But are shrimp tacos actually cheaper this time around?
The reason we brought up shrimp is actually shrimp prices have not increased over the last 5 years. But when you look at the other proteins on the grill, and they're looking at 12 to 15% year-over-year increases. So, again, all about relative value. So we'll see the shoppers looking for relative value. If shrimp was already on your grill, you may have more of it this time. If there's something else that you like, then you're going to be maybe looking for substitutions in the frozen food case or some new innovative menu items.
Katie, you like shrimp?
No, I don't. I was going to say shrimp prices probably haven't gone up because it's a weird food.
It's not a weird food. It's a great food.
Weird texture.
All right,
not
on.
A fan. But in any case, I also want to talk about alcohol because personally, I don't really like beer. I'm more of a white wine gal. But a lot of people drink beer and other beverages at the 4th of July. What's the outlook there?
It does look like some of the higher-priced beverages in the beer case are up 20-25%. And we're already seeing demand flow to the domestic super premium brands. So people are already making a change. And the white wine, and especially chilled white wine, is still out there. And there's some great, amazing brands that are at lower price points if you're still looking to fill, to pair with a really nice wine.
Well, that's so good.
You're going to be okay.
Okay.
All right. So talk to me, too, about veggies or things like avocados, which we know have been expensive. We've talked about shortages, I feel like, over the last year or so. Where are we on that?
Well, avocado shortages is another story altogether. Mostly supply chain. There's always a perishability issue and weather-driven issues. But California avocados are just about to come into season, into the peak of the season. So look for your produce department again. Seasonality is going to drive a lot. When there's higher supply, you're going to see prices get moderated. And things move quickly. It's a very dynamic space in the produce section. So talk about sort of weird textures. People talk about that with avocados, but once you are a fan, it's usually a lifetime issue.
So are you saying they're expensive, but they're around?
No, I actually think the price is going to come down because we're going to have better supplies because we're coming into the California season.
Okay, do you like avocados?
Actually, I eat an avocado every single morning, half of one, an entire avocado. Let the record show.
Good. It's so healthy for you. So healthy. I'm glad to hear it.
Carol, we only have about 30 seconds left, but we've covered the main course. We've covered beverages. What about dessert? What's the outlook there?
Well, I think you might want to look at some of the non-dairy alternatives. I am a big fan of the real milk people, so don't forget the real ice cream. But it does look like those prices are going to be up substantially.
I like a hot fudge sundae on my July 4th. I'm just going to say it. And a little bit of watermelon as well. All right, we got to run. Have a great holiday, a safe holiday. Carol Flynn, she's ag tech analyst over at Wells Fargo, joining us on the phone in California.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Keep driving you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just about 11 minutes left in today's trading session. We have been bouncing around. Slight gain on the Dow, as you just heard from Charlie. A little bit lower on both the NASDAQ and the S&P. So off our highs and lows of the session. Talk about searching for direction. So let's get to it. Delighted to have with us Stephanie Pierce. She's CEO of Dreyfus Mellon and ETFs for BNY Mellon Investment Management. She is in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio with Katie. And she and I were in Dallas at BNY Mellon Pershing Insight 2022. We talked about a lot of things, including the future of money, which we'll get to in just a moment. But Stephanie, so great to have you. How are you?
Great to see you. It's feels like it was just a week or two ago that we were on stage together.
Yeah, it was just so, I felt like it was so forward thinking about, kind of our discussions. But let's be present right now. And as we look at this market, we talked about volatility in that panel. We continue to see it here in the market environment. What are you seeing in terms of fund flows that tells you about what investors are thinking about right now?
You know, Carol, it's really powerful to see the fund flows in ETFs this year. You know, what I think it tells you is markets go up or down, but ETFs are still the vehicle of choice for investors. As of the kind of May kind of month end, we were almost $260 billion in ETF net inflows year to date. And that just tells you that that's only going in one direction.
And, I mean, beyond that, beyond the inflows, year-to-date inflows that you are seeing, I mean, what are the trends within that those flows? Because it feels like it's pretty broken apart.
Well, it's interesting. Surprisingly, with all the volatility in equities that Carol mentioned, we're still seeing very significant flows into equity ETFs. That was about $94 billion of the $260 billion. And within that, there's definitely some more defensive trends, right? So you're seeing healthcare ETFs take a lot of the flows there relative to some of the more cyclical areas like financials and technology that have been in outflow. The other piece that I would mention, though, is the continued growth in fixed income and cash-like ETF product, which was another $50 billion in flows. And of that, about 25 or half of it, $25 billion of it was in ultra-short ETFs. So I guess the short version of that is that, you know, cash and fixed income, sort of plain vanilla yield-oriented product, are really going to start to give more esoteric yield vehicles a run for their money as you continue to see rates creep up.
Well, that's actually what sorry to jump in, but that's something that I've been thinking about a lot because I was looking at some of the ultra-short duration cash-like ETFs, and they're actually starting to pay dividends, pennies, but something.
They are. And if you look at where we are today, right, so we're coming up on another Fed meeting in, you know, the end of July. Markets are pricing in a 75% probability of 75 basis points. And then if you fast forward to the end of the year, based on what, you know, is being priced in terms of Fed action, we could be at 3.5% just in a cash-like product. And then you go out the curve a little bit, you get more than that. Right? That's pretty interesting. I would go as far as to say it's pretty sexy relative to, you know, the liquid alts and the other esoteric products that people have been using to get yield. You may not need to do that if you can get it in vanilla fixed income.
So sexy because, you know, at this point we talk a lot about capital preservation, Stephanie, and that's really kind of what investors need to be thinking about.
That's exactly right. I think investors not only cyclically, Carol, but also demographically, right? The search for yield is not just because we haven't seen 3% on money markets or cash product in 10 years. It's also because we have an aging demographic in this country that need that more structurally for their lifestyles.
So give me an idea in terms of, Stephanie, and market cycles. Like, you know, we've talked about that it's typically about 8 months between when the Fed stops raising rates to when it starts to cut rates, which is a short period of time. Markets are forward looking, right? I mean, what are you looking for when you get an idea that this maybe down market cycle, at least on the equity side of things, is coming to an end?
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, sometimes we joke about the perspective any of us have on markets is probably worth the price of a cup of coffee. That being said, I think, you know, our view is that, you know, the real question is around inflation, Carol.
Yeah.
And that's really what the markets are focused on. That's what people are looking at in terms of earnings and multiples and what's really going to impact the equity markets as well as psychology, as well as whether people are, you know, employed and continue to spend, right? So if the Fed strikes the right balance where we know the Fed is behind the curve on inflation, if the Fed can strike the right balance, then I think you'll see markets stabilize.
Jay Powell thinks he can, right, Katie? We heard this from him today. Mm-hmm. But he's not. He thinks he can. So, Stephanie, how comfortable do you feel in an environment that we're coming off of that we've never lived through before that you think the Fed can get it right? Because they are going to be aggressive. We know that.
They're definitely going to be aggressive. You know, it's interesting. You may be familiar with our chief economist, Vincent Reinhardt, who's a former Fed official, Fed watcher par excellence. And certainly, I think Vincent is talking about a fine balance here in terms of not turning this into a recession. But it's a very tricky balance given how behind the Fed has been on inflation. So look, they have to get it right for us to continue the, you know, upward trend that we've seen over many, many years in equity markets. You know, it's going to be a really interesting market to watch here for the next few months.
And I'd love to broaden this conversation out a little bit and talk about crypto. I know that you were on a really riveting panel with Carol in Dallas. I wasn't there, you guys, but
you should have been because it was really smart. And so let's talk about, you know, Stephanie, I loved it because we talked specifically about, you know, what's the future of money. And we had Matt Walsh, founder of founding partner at Castle Island Ventures. We had Matt Hogan, a CIO at Bitwise. I mean, you guys really came at it from different perspectives. They are in on the crypto world, but said we were very early in. How do you guys at your company think about where you need to be in this space?
Sure. Well, from a broad perspective, BNY Mellon seeks to be a leader in the digital asset space. As you know, we're a leading custody bank. We're really in all parts of the cash ecosystem. And as our clients look to us for digital asset solutions as a place to keep their money or trade their money or manage their money, we want to be a leader there. So that's kind of the short answer. Now, what does that really look like? It's going to go in different stages, right? The regulators have a key role to play. And I think what we saw, Carol, after some of the crypto events and the dislocation that happened a few weeks ago, is that the regulators are going to come in and provide some standards, particularly as relates to the reserve management underneath some of these cryptocurrencies and stablecoins.
Which I felt like you guys all welcomed that idea, that we would get some regulatory oversight.
It has to happen. There was too much white space here, and I think that, plus, as the guys on the panel pointed out, there was a lot of leverage as well as just not a lot of regulation, and that created some of the outcomes that we have. I mean, the reality is the reason people have confidence in traditional currencies is because there is a fully transparent, fully liquid, hard currency backing in reserve management in every central bank around the world, and that wasn't the case in stablecoins. And it needs to be.
Well, talking about crypto, talking about regulation, talking about ETFs, let's wrap it all together because there's a very important SEC decision coming on a Grayscale application to convert their Bitcoin trust into an ETF. I got to ask, is a spot physically backed Bitcoin ETF going to become a reality sometime soon?
Well, if you hadn't said soon, I probably would have said likely. I think the question is when, right? Clearly, investors love the wrapper that they're comfortable with, the liquidity, the transparency, the way it works in the pipes of every advisor and retail investor in this country. That's why this is so attractive. Having said that, as we just talked about, it remains to be seen how the regulators will really standardize some of the components I mentioned, right? Whether that's transparency, liquidity, reserve management. And until that's in place, I think you'll see this probably take a little bit of time. Doesn't mean it won't happen. I think the direction of travel is clear that even beyond the underlying of that specific instance, the idea of blockchain and digital ledger is here to stay. It's just a question of when, not if.
All right, Stephanie, I'm so jealous I'm not in studio with you. You have to promise to come back when I am COVID clear. I mean, I'm negative, everybody, but they're just still quarantining me because I loved our conversation and I want to continue it with you. Stephanie Pierce, she's Chief Executive Officer of Dreyfus Mellon and ETFs over at BNY Mellon Investment Management, joining us in our Interactive Broker Studio. I highly recommend you go back to the Insight 22 conversations and check out our panel, which was all about reimagining the future of money.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.